The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We give voice to those who challenge a prevailing sentiment in global financial markets. This podcast is for informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests were not compensated for their appearance, nor do they supply payment in order to appear. Individuals on this podcast may hold positions in the securities that are discussed. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. This podcast episode may have ads and the occasional announcement. To listen without ads or announcements and take advantage of a host of other benefits, consider becoming a premium subscriber. Visit the website contrarian.supercast.tech. That's TECH for more information. Now, here's your host, Mr. Nathaniel E. Baker.
This podcast episode was recorded on Wednesday, May 31st, and made available to premium subscribers the following day, on Thursday, June 1st. So almost a full week ago. If you want to become a premium subscriber, it is very easy to do so. Visit the website, contrarian.supercast.com, or our Substack, contrarianpod.substack.com. Benefits are exactly the same at both sites, and they include the Daily Contrarian podcast and briefing, which is released every market day morning by 7 a.m. And this takes a look at the economic data releases, earnings, and other events in the day ahead as a kind of preview of the trading day, all from a contrarian viewpoint, of course. There are numerous other benefits as well. These are all described on the websites mentioned, which are, again, contrarian.supercast.com, contrarianpod.substack.com. Oh yeah, one of the benefits, you don't have to listen to any of these annoying ads or announcements. Take advantage. I'll see you there. Now, on with today's podcast. Here you go. Enjoy. Naomi Fink, you are the founder and CEO of Europacifica Consulting out there in Los Angeles, California. Thank you so much for joining the Contrarian Investor Podcast today. And I'm very excited because I've known you for a long time, but I've not had you on the podcast yet. But you have some rather contrarian views on inflation. And inflation is something we hear the narrative that it is coming down and that soon the Fed will be able to cut rates, will have to cut rates because of a slowing economy. But you don't quite have that view, at least when it comes to inflation. You view inflation as much more persistent. Tell me about that.
Certainly. Well, I think inflation is something that perhaps caught markets and households and investors by surprise. And perhaps it's becoming more the norm to see it sticking around. But traditionally, inflation expectations have been very persistent recently in the last few years. We've had very low inflation expectations. So I think it's natural. We've had very low inflation and that gave rise to low inflation expectations. And so I think it's natural to think that inflation is going to abate and we're going to go back into a very low inflation regime. I disagree. On the other side, I don't see any hyperinflation expectation, but I think that we're going to normalize around a positive rate of inflation, which has been in question over the past few years, and I think it's no longer going to be in question. I think there are several reasons from a macroeconomic perspective why we're not going to see a sudden return to an ultra low inflation environment. One has been the reversal of globalization, at least partially. We saw saw a decline in prices on trend ever since China joined the WTO at the start of the millennium. And there was a lot of downward pressure on prices with globalization. And that at least partially has started to reverse, and some of it's probably not going to come back anytime soon. Another aspect is that, we heard about Moore's Law for such a long time, and now it appears to be something of the past. And I'm not saying that there's not going to be any new technological innovation. I think there is, but it's going to be a challenge to find it. I don't think that that just ever cheaper, ever larger capacity semiconductors is going to be a very steady, dependable source of downward price pressure for producers, especially. So I think that there are some. There's also probably a lot of interim, maybe not long term, but geopolitical pressures that are supply shocks, unrest that are likely to keep prices on the rise rather than the decline. And then we've seen the other side of some of the demographic pressures that we thought were going to be bring deflation, which is labor supply shortages. So we learned that that demographics can also lend itself to inflationary moves, which is a completely different interpretation than we had a few years ago when prices were on the downtrend.
Yeah, that's a bunch of stuff right there. Now, where does this leave Fed policy? And does the Fed and their fight against inflation, which has taken the form of QT and interest rate hikes, is that not having an effect at all in your view? Is it having a minimal effect? Do they need to try something new? What's going on there?
Well, it may be argued that we would be worse off had the Fed done nothing, and perhaps we would be in a much more inflationary regime. That's possible. And just keeping in mind that the Fed can only really influence inflation expectations rather than inflation that's already happened. Once the news is out, once the prices have risen, the only thing the Fed really can do is try to bring those inflation expectations back around again. So potentially that's been one thing they've been at least partially successful at. The one thing that that the Fed isn't able to do is to eliminate business cycles. And so I think the Fed is going to have to certainly, in the context of business cycles, respond. If we do see higher inflation, if we do see demand holding steady, yeah, it makes sense that they raise rates. And if we do see a recession and then the inflation starts to abate, I would expect them to cut. I think longer term, though, despite the business cycle, we're probably going to see a normalization to a more positive rate of inflation over the next few years. That's my view.
Will they be able to cut if inflation is still stubborn at 5% plus CPI or even 4%?
So I would imagine that inflation is likely to fluctuate, and I wouldn't expect it staying at one level. So it's possible that that if we do see demand soften, then prices will come lower. I just don't expect them to stay lower. Yeah. I think that it's possible to have a business cycle even if on trend prices continue to rise. I would think that softer demand would translate into softer price rises as well. Mm-hmm. I just don't think that that's going to be a permanent phenomenon where the Fed can just step away. And then I certainly don't see the Fed getting worried about deflation anytime soon.
Yeah, it seems that deflation is a word of a bygone era at this stage for all the reasons you mentioned. Now, what does the Fed do potentially about their mandate and also their target of 2% CPI? Is that out the window, or do you think they can achieve that, or do they need to redo it?
Well, I think once again we're thinking of the Fed's target is a long-term target, and it operates monetary policy around that target. And I think historically, 2% on average hasn't been a very wild target. it's possible that we do see that target need to shift upwards if we see these persistent price pressures on the upside. I think it might be a little too soon to say that we should throw away that target, because again, we haven't really seen what prices do during the recession yet. And that's very important in determining the long-term average.
Mm. Do you anticipate a recession this year or soon for the US?
I am hesitant to say I anticipate an imminent recession, but I'm pretty convinced that we will see a recession sometime. I think that we have not eradicated recessions, just like we didn't eradicate inflation. And whether it's this year or whether it's next year, I think that there is going to be a recession. There is going to be the other side of the business cycle at some point. And then it looks like, since we have seen quite a healthy expansion up until now, and there are some, you know, there have been some late cycle signals, whether it's this year or next year, it's probably inevitable.
Okay. Where does this leave investors? And you have a lot of people retiring, the baby boomers, of course. So you have more people who are going to be on fixed income. Some of them maybe and are postponing their retirement. That's another story for another day. But what does an investor do with this higher inflation, secular higher inflation?
Well, this is one thing I have been looking at relatively closely, the impact of inflation on real incomes, especially on real incomes over the life cycle in retirement, and how that might impact retirement decision making, including on timing of retirement. And it can have a real influence, and it's probably an influence that we haven't counted on. For example, if we see persistent inflation, persistent higher inflation, then the higher the inflation, the more we can expect it to eat into real income and therefore into consumption of households. We can actually, even though short term, perhaps less intuitively, we tend to see sort of savings and consumption act in opposite ways. Over the long term, inflation can eat into asset building as well, just by virtue of having less in terms of real income, therefore not having less in terms of means to save. Inflation can act as a deterrent to savings longer term, which is also obviously in retirement not going to help much to maintain purchasing power if you have the combination of the inflation eroding purchasing power already and reduced savings. So that's not so good. Interestingly, though, when you do have greater price fluctuations, and those price fluctuations translate into expectations of greater volatility in real incomes, people do tend to engage in precautionary savings. That can be seen from empirical data, and then also when we translate it to a theoretical model, it makes theoretical sense. You expect more volatile real income over your lifetime. You save more and you save earlier. It's possible that there could be some impact to savings behaviors. I would emphasize, though, savings behaviors in a theoretical model don't necessarily translate to greater financial literacy in the real world. So I would think that financial literacy is one important tool, particularly when we look at understanding of inflation. It's an important tool to help households cope with fluctuations in real income.
Yeah. Also, there's an option for you: invest in financial literacy, like, you know, podcasts and such, just for example. I'm wondering if you've seen here.
Sick of me yet? Become a premium subscriber and avoid all ads or interruptions. Other benefits as well. Visit contrarian.supercast.tech for more information.
Going back to inflation and consumer purchasing power, the big retailers, they reported earnings over the last couple of weeks. Walmart, Home Depot, Target, Lowe's, they all pretty much said the same thing, which is that consumers are pulling back on big discretionary item purchases. I'm not sure if you saw that, and if you think that maybe this is some of this inflation stuff coming home to roost, because as you mentioned at the outset, this would affect consumers' purchasing. So you think that could be, or is that just the business cycle?
So I would say that might be indicative more of the business cycle, yeah. Simply because if we're looking at the pure influence of inflation, you should be bringing forward a lot of those purchases because you think it's going to cost more in the future if you're looking at trend inflation. So I would say that those are more business cycle indicators rather than a real fear of deeply entrenched inflation.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, that makes sense. So where else, what other concerns do you have as for this as far as the longer term prospects of inflation are concerned? What can consumers do? What can investors do?
Well, investors are probably going to have their work cut out for them. Mm. And I say this because the firm is also going to be influenced by inflation. And it's probably going to be the firm's job really to adapt to the new normal in terms of inflation. So we've already seen some spikes in purchasing in the purchasing price index, and some companies have done their best to absorb that and ultimately pass on the price rises to consumers whilst attempting to maintain their own market power. They've seemed to do that relatively well so far, but again, I would like to see that over an entire business cycle, and it's certainly a different phenomenon altogether to deal with a temporary spike in inflation and a return to low inflation versus more volatile inflation or higher inflation over the long term. I think that companies are going to have to innovate in order to deal with higher trend inflation and less predictable inflation. That means they can't just rely on the same downward trends, whether it's globalization or Moore's Law or all of these very reliable, predictable trends that we've had characterizing the last decade, if not more. I think they're going to have to get inventive and creative and think of new ways they can harness technology. And I mean technology in the broader sense. I don't just mean development of new tools, new technological tools, or consumer-facing technology. I'm also thinking of creative ways to allocate labor and capital. And one thing I have to bring up here is that companies are probably going to be they're going to be dealing with a skills shortage for quite some time. Alongside the decline in prices over the last couple of decades, we've seen this decline in labor share of capital. And sure, that's possible if just by mobilizing capital, then you can continue to maintain your productivity. But there are some signals that that's not going to be possible. There's not been that much attention paid on allocation of labor or just being able to cultivate human capital compared to physical capital. So I think that's the new frontier. The firms that are better able to cultivate the human capital and to retain the human capital, to allocate the human capital, are probably going to be those who are going to be strongest in a higher inflation environment.
Interesting. One thing you didn't mention here was AI, artificial intelligence, major buzzword, of course, nowadays. And one of the ways that people are talking about using it, of course, is to potentially displace certain workers, maybe the way that the factories did and other advances in productivity in years past. Do you think that can be one way that can help, or is that just all hype?
So I will have to be the contrarian here, good. Probably no better place to do it.
Yeah.
I believe that AI is an extremely useful tool, but I believe that's what it is. It's a tool. It can help us complete tasks. It but tasks rather than jobs. Mm. I believe that that jobs are still a very much human phenomenon, and certainly those who are less capable of using the new technology, including IA, are probably going to AI are going to be at a disadvantage. That said, humans are very adaptable creatures. I think that we have the capability to learn an enormous amount of things, and on top of that, we're able to emote, we're able to have empathy, we're able to think of new things that haven't been invented before. Something that that AI has difficulty doing, given that most of AI uses pattern detection, granted over large sets of data. And then there's a great, I think the scariest thing about AI to me is not the propensity for to usurp human labor, but just to get it wrong. I think I was at AEA one year, and then there was a presentation given on AI, and one of the points that was brought up was that AI is supremely good at detecting patterns. So, for example, if you want to distinguish cats from dogs, AI tools are getting better and better at distinguishing cats from dogs, like a picture of a cat versus a picture of a dog. But that's dependent on the information that you give it. So if there is a disproportionate number of pictures of cats on pianos, then the AI is going to think that black and white oblong rectangles are characteristics of a cat, whereas, common sense humans, we know it's not. So I think that that there are definitely uses for AI, and it's possible, I guess, especially given our given human history, that if we fail to incorporate it and fail to adapt, then there are going to be losses in human jobs. But I think it's probably our duty as both as part of the economy individually, and then also our policymakers to really try and figure out how best the economy might adapt to incorporate these new tools, and also to keep them in check, especially when they get it badly wrong.
Mm. Yeah, you touched on it. I mean, you still need to program these things, right? And there's a lot that can go wrong, and it's not just something where you flip a switch and you go away and that's the end of it. So yeah, there is that. Very cool. Naomi Fink of Euro-Pacifica Consulting. I want to take a short break now, give a chance for our sponsors to make themselves heard. And we'll come back then and ask you some more questions. If you are a premium subscriber, do not touch the dial. You will not get the break. We'll be right back. In fact, we already are. And everybody else, to become a premium subscriber, visit the website contrarianpod.substack.com and sign up.
We hope you're enjoying this episode of the Contrarian Investor Podcast, where we give voice to those who challenge a prevailing narrative in global financial markets. Consider becoming a premium subscriber. For $9 a month or less, premium subscribers receive a number of benefits. Podcasts are posted immediately after they're recorded. Transcripts are made available within 24 hours. Premium subscribers get direct access to the host. And of course, there are no ads or interruptions. Visit contrarian.supercast.tech for more information.
By the way, you don't need the .tech suffix to get to that website. .com will do the trick. And we also have a Substack that you can, where you can sign up for the same prices, same benefits, same details. contrarianpod.substack.com. So if you already have a Substack account and use it, or have the app and use that, that's probably the best way to go. So contrarian.supercast.com or contrarianpod.substack.com, whole bunch of benefits, including, of course, getting this episode up to a week early without ads or annoying announcements. And you also get the Daily Contrarian briefing and podcast that is released every market day morning at 7 a.m. This is a contrarian take on the events of the day ahead and what is likely to move markets, such as economic data releases, earnings, and other things. It is really good, and that is completely unbiased, of course. So check that out, contrarianpod.substack.com or contrarian.supercast.tech. Now on with the show.
Welcome back, everybody. Naomi Fink of Euro Pacifica Consulting. Naomi, this is the segment of the show where we have the guest tell us a little bit more about herself and her station in life and how she came to arrive at it and professional background and such. I know you have a pretty long history on Wall Street. Before you restarted Euro Pacifica Consulting last year, if I'm not mistaken. So talk to us about that.
Yeah, so I did found Euro Pacifica about 10 years ago, and it was pretty much a macro shop. We were doing consulting on macro with a big Asia focus, given my own experience in Asia, especially Japan, as you might be able to tell with the logo here.
The logo of Mount Fuji for those who aren't watching, yes.
And I recently have restarted Euro Pacifica to encompass not only the macro side of things, but also the household micro retirement. Since I've spent the last 6 years focusing on retirements and household consumer choice myself, and I'm still the chairperson of eBreeze Retirement Security Research Center. So, there's probably a lot of macro and micro coming together right now in the world. So, I'm excited to marry the two and delve into it some more.
Mm-hmm. And you have a pretty long history on Wall Street as well. Some of your jobs were macro focused, right?
That's correct. I started my research career as a Forex strategist, an experience I certainly welcome and celebrate today. It's just kind of a nice way to see the world in financial terms. You're always looking at relative economies, so you're never looking at just one. Even if your concern is the U.S. dollar, it's always the U.S. dollar against the rest of the world. It's trade partners, the investment inward and outward. I thought it was a wonderful foundation on which to explore other asset classes. I spent a bit of time in pure macro as well, looking at Japan, which is at once probably one of the world's most fascinating and frustrating economies, given the failure to exit deflation for decades. Mm. And I've also looked at the equity market, at the Japan equity market, which is now on the rebound. It looks like the reflation is doing it some good, not to mention the yen weakness. Of late, as I mentioned, I've been focusing on multi-asset world and looking at asset allocations especially for households, thinking of retirement, saving for retirement, and of course in retirement. Mm-hmm. This has been certainly a new focus and a new set of decisions that have merited understanding some of the macro factors through a new lens, the lens of choices that are often influenced by not necessarily rational decision making.
Mm, indeed, and this is one of the reasons for being contrarian, or at least having a contrarian view in mind. Speaking of which, Japan equities have gotten a lot of press recently. Warren Buffett investing in them, and a little bit of hype reemerging now, as it tends to do periodically every couple of years. But this time it seems like there's a little more behind it. And from a contrarian perspective, that would not be when one wants to invest in this market. But for Japanese stocks, do you think this is still a good time, or is it not so much?
Well, I think that there has been a chronic undervaluation problem with Japanese equities, as there does tend to be every time we see a situation where probably growth in the rest of the world eclipses Japan. But we have now this situation where not only do we have undervaluation in Japanese equities, but we also have a very cheap yen, which is not only good for trade, because as we know there was a lot of globalization of Japan's trade too, but it's a good environment for investment for foreign investors. So I think that's one of the big reasons why a lot of the capital is going into Japan now. Structural factors, I would say that there's a good chance. I'm not going to say that that it's a foregone conclusion, but I think there's a good chance that Japan now has the means whereby to incorporate some necessary structural reforms. With inflation coming back into the question, it's not just a foregone conclusion that you can leave cash at the bank at near 0% interest and still be able to buy more tomorrow thanks to deflation. So now there's an incentive to have to work to allocate the capital a little bit more. Possibly that's going to lend itself to more investment-friendly governance practices among Japanese companies. And so there have been some hopeful signals. I mean, even over the last years when people didn't like Japan at all, you know, there's been a governance code and a stewardship code introduced. There's been a lot more focus on by large investors, even within Japan, on the governance of firms. There's a lot more ESG focus, for instance, in Japan and probably the rest of the world, whereas it's very, as we know, controversial in the United States. But I mean, the G of ESG is governance. And insofar as governance is related to return on assets, an improvement in governance is probably an improvement in return on equity for Japan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Any particular sectors within the Japanese economy that you think might be particularly compelling?
Well, I think to begin with, the sectors that have traditionally been very competitive in Japan have been those who are the traditional exporters. So whether it's in the electronics or heavy industry or IT related, then I think those are probably the clear near-term performers. The harder ones are going to be the services sector firms. And that's also, though, where we see the test of governance. If we're actually seeing real change, then the services sector, which has tended to be kind of a buffer, I mean, it's a lot more domestic than some of these other sectors. It's been traditionally where jobs have been, there's been the cushion to the deflation and years of stagnant growth. Not a lot of jobs have been shed in Japan. If you compare it to, for instance, U.S. economic cycles, in the U.S., during economic cycles, then there's a lot more job destruction or job elimination. In Japan, traditionally, there's been a lot more pay cuts. And then that itself is deflationary. I'm not saying that that Japan is going to suddenly move to an American model of job elimination in cycles, but it's possible that with the demographics, there's an aging demographic, there is a supply shortage in Japan, there's possibility to really try and get the balance right of investment in labor and capital and allocation in labor and capital, and perhaps what we were discussing earlier, the investment in AI and how we use AI matters. Well, this might be a key point for aging Japan. If we get the ability of the labor in the market already to leverage the benefits of the existing technology, we might get a good boost to productivity, and productivity as macroeconomists have modeled is the long-term driver of growth.
Very interesting. Cool. All right, let's go back to inflation really quick. And there's been cost of living adjustments in Social Security. But you've looked into this a little bit, I think, and apparently these are not keeping up with the actual prices. Is that right? Tell me about that.
By construction, yes. Okay. The Social Security cost of living adjustments are based on past months of price rises. So you are by definition always lagging. I guess if you have volatile inflation, then you'll get a buffer after a period of high prices, and then that will still last when prices come back down again. I think the issue here, though, is if we have trend inflation, that's not necessarily going to be the best for retirees who aren't earning wage income. Beyond that, Social Security, the cost of living adjustments, as backward looking as they are, still are sort of appear to be at least the state of the art in terms of cost of living adjustments in pensions. So there are many pensions, public pensions, that have a far lower or a much more partial adjustment for cost of living than Social Security, and that might be a worry. It's been probably pretty easy to cut down on some of the liabilities of public pensions by reducing cost of living adjustments without people really feeling too much pain in periods of low inflation. But as we head into a period of higher inflation and more volatile inflation, people might feel the effect a lot more of not having that cost of living adjustment. They're going to have to do other things to protect their purchasing power, whether it's work longer or whether it's work part-time, whether they can come up with an investment strategy that offers them a greater inflation buffer from their own savings. There are new considerations when we look at volatility and in inflation and potential higher or reduced real income due to inflation.
Yeah. And it sounds like this would all be bad for the consumer. And
There's a cost of living, or there's a apart from the cost of living index for Social Security, there's an experimental price index for older Americans, the CPIE, and I think that's probably going to be something that we should keep a very close eye on. I think one of the things in a low inflation period maybe unduly punished older Americans was the cost of medical care. Even in low inflation environments, then the cost of medical care remained very, very high and rising at rates not seen in other sectors. So then that was a worry, but that was a worry in a particular sector. I don't know if we can compartmentalize that anymore for older Americans. It might be a greater challenge now to maintain across the board purchasing power in retirement, not limited to medical.
Wow. What is the CPIE? What goes into it other than what would normally be in the regular CPI?
Yeah, so I mean, it's very similar to the regular CPI. It's just weighted such that it represents the consumption basket of older Americans. So, for example, you'll have a higher weighting on medical costs. You'll have probably a lower weighting on discretionary items that you associate with working individuals. It's probably mostly in the weightings that you'll see the difference.
Interesting. Wow. Yeah. Okay. So, what does one do there? I mean, one thing that I was thinking about when you're talking about Japan and with its demographic problem is retiring in Japan. But there's a whole bunch of hurdles there. But there's Mexico, there's Central America, there's a number of places for Americans at least that are closer. And there has been a lot of talk about that. That aside, what kind of options does one have as a retiree to cut down on costs and to keep the income?
Well, as you mentioned, there is the choice of moving. And I'm not even thinking of moving outside of the United States. That's always an option. But there's a a big dispersion in cost of living within the United States. Recently, I worked on a project with Alameda County, and that's one of the higher cost areas in the United States. If you want to retire in Alameda County, you'd want a pretty competitive income replacement rate. Of course, if you are going to retire, I'm thinking of somewhere ultra low cost, maybe a rural area in
Oklahoma.
Then you're not going to need the same resources that that you're going to need to maintain your standard of living in Alameda County. That's one, but there are many other things that that households can use to maintain their purchasing power. One is investment, and of course, I mean we know that investment presupposes that you have sufficient savings to allocate. And if you are in that position of allocating savings, then you would want to be allocating them to assets that are more inflation resistant. And as I mentioned earlier, that ties in with the firms problem. If you're able to select firms and the assets of firms that are particularly resilient to inflation, so pioneering new technology, ability to pass along price rises, ability to change the to substitute and change the mix of inputs in order to maintain production at lower cost, that's the type of firm that you'd want in your portfolio. I am aware though that sometimes there are problems that have nothing to do with investment. For instance, saving enough in the first place, that's a big challenge for the average American household, especially given the cuts to things like the fact that there are DB pensions are few and far between, even those with, not to mention those with cost of living adjustments. Yeah. We also have some recent changes in defined contribution regulation that have just taken effect. So we don't know whether that's going to be enough to really help people overcome this hurdle of insufficiency of private retirement savings. There's also financial literacy, which might contribute to saving too little to begin with. So, how do we actually get people to save from early enough and enjoy all those years of compounding when they have day-to-day challenges to deal with? Such as allocating their household income to living expenses, for one. That's something that I don't think we have a magic solution for. Also, longevity. I think that's one of the reasons why Social Security is having a lot of challenges with the Social Security Trust Fund is likely to run out soon. So. So we're either going to have to boost the payments in or cut the benefits, one or the other.
Or raise retirement age. I mean, that would seem something they need to do anyway. I mean, when Social Security was enacted, the average life expectancy was a lot lower than it is now.
But by default, that's a cut to benefits too, because you got fewer years of benefit. And if we do raise the Social Security eligibility age, then that also implies working longer. So, if we were to accommodate working longer, then employers have to make some adjustments to their policies. They're probably going to have to think of ways in which they can accommodate Medicare eligible workers, for example, because Medicare eligibility age is 65 and full Social Security, the full retirement age is 67 and maximum is 70. So, so it's very feasible that you'll have a lot greater proportion of your workforce being Medicare eligible. There's some adjustments that need to be made.
Employers would like that though, wouldn't they? Because it would be less insurance cost for them if they're already covered by Medicare.
Well, I mean, there are probably some, certainly some advantages, and it probably is, but it's still up to employers to kind of change the mix of their benefits and also the mix of employment arrangements. It's possible. I mean, what we've seen is that people tend to retire. And some of them tend to retire sooner than they originally expected. And some of those people stay retired, but some of them unretire. So do we have all of the logistics and the structure in place for people to unretire and potentially work part-time or go back into a different full-time arrangement with the Medicare? It's like that. I think there's a lot that still has the infrastructure that hasn't been set up yet. I mean, we're also working on trying to prevent leakage from retirement plans, which tends to happen when people leave employment for whatever reason. And I think it was David Laibson at several AEAs ago that demonstrated how you can have a really high contribution rate while you're working, but you have enough periods of unemployment, and then that can all just disappear by retirement age. And so we haven't really conquered that yet in the United States. We're working on things like portability, but it's not perfect. We haven't really addressed the whole longevity problem. Maybe some of it will be supplying labor for longer, but then also people tend to be they're more susceptible to medical conditions as they get older. So it's possible that there will be a substantial cohort that would like to work longer but is unable to work longer. And usually if you're elderly and you have a medical condition, that requires caregiving too. And I think one of the recent EBRI conferences has focused on caregiving, and that's another area that we haven't quite figured out yet. How do we support the an aging economy, a caregiving economy, and try to supply the right choices all throughout the life cycle, including into traditional retirement age?
Yeah, those are all big questions. And again, it just doesn't look good for the consumer from all of this, especially if you're talking about financial literacy thing. But a lot of financial literacy involves not spending money frivolously and not spending money you don't have and not buying things you don't need, which, let's face it, is a kind of a big part of the global economy. And Americans doing these things, including on credit, has kind of been the lifeblood of the global economy for some time now, hasn't it?
Well, when you say that, it reminds me of a debate that I used to have, an ongoing debate with a Japanese economist when I was in Tokyo. The Japanese economist told me, well, you Americans always tell us to consume more in Japan. And that's why we're mired in deflation and we have no growth. But look at you, you're consuming a whole bunch of stuff you don't need on credit. That's right. And I can't say that's not true. And then as we've seen, credit and debt tends to be corrosive to some individual consumers, savers, livelihoods and lives. However, there's probably a happy medium in between having, you know, years of deflation and poor growth, and having this profligate spending that we Americans are accused of engaging in. I think that there's probably a happy medium where you do have a decent amount of financial literacy, and it's not about taking no risk, right? I mean, if we took no risk, we wouldn't have mortgages. We wouldn't have the ability to prefer taking a trip to Italy when we're young to enrich ourselves rather than dedicating all of that amount to retirement savings. So it's all probably about making understanding the choices that you're making and their ramifications rather than just shutting down and doing nothing but saving. I think that the way that we build a well balanced household within the economy is to try to figure out what risks are worth taking and what the trade-offs actually are, and not to to never engage in the trade-offs, but really understand what that's going to do for us, and to try to adapt as well with some of the situations that we're faced with, including higher inflation. And so, yeah, I think that's a task for the government. That's a task for households. That's a task for the firms. And then we're probably going to see it play out in markets. There are going to be those who are, especially amongst the firms, who adapt successfully, much more publicly, and those who adapt less successfully. Unfortunately, we don't have as clear a read on the households until after it's happened.
Yeah.
So probably engaging in things like preventive measures, you know, the education, financial education campaigns, especially trying to reach underrepresented households, trying to help them, help give them the tools to better their own lot. That's of course part of the problem. I'm not saying though financial literacy is going to cure the world's ills, because there's still a role for other players in the
economy. Of course, yeah. And to your point, America is just 330 million people or so, in a world of what, 7 billion now. So if you have other consumers come online in emerging markets and pick up their purchasing power, you figure that would be able to pick up the slack for the US, although it kind of hasn't happened yet, but it's a slow process, obviously. And, you know, maybe it has started to happen in China, started to. Yeah.
Well, certainly you'd expect emerging economies to grow more quickly on trends. And I think it's probably a benefit if we do see a lot of those economies show an ability to use resources such that that they are able to bring consumers to a more satisfactory standard of living, but then also probably do it in a way that maybe the U.S. hasn't been the best at, which is trying to use resources in a smart way over time for posterity. There's probably a lot of room to develop on that front.
Yes, indeed there is. Yes, there is. All right, very cool. Naomi Fink of Euro Pacifica Consulting. So I get the Pacific reference. Where does the Euro come from? Is that, on Euro Pacifica?
Yeah, so I must say that that comes from my own personal history. I've spent a lot of time, both in work and education, in Europe, looking at Europe. I speak a couple of European languages. I've tended to favor a lot of the connections between Europe and Asia, since there's a lot of European investment in Asia Pacific. There's a lot of influence. There's, you know, trade, and I've tended to look at some of those cross-border relationships, and
what European countries did you live in, out of curiosity?
So I spent some time in the UK. I did my university years there in Scotland. I spent a year of that in Spain, in Bilbao. I also did my graduate school at Barcelona Graduate School of Economics. And there's certainly a lot of a very healthy macroeconomic community there in Barcelona. It's definitely worthwhile picking the brains of some of the researchers there.
No question.
I spent some time in France. Both as a young person in high school, and then also while working for BNP Paribas, I think that that there's a lot of exchange between Japan and Europe, simply because of the similar demographic challenges that they've had to face, and also some of the, I think that Europe wasn't expecting this, but some of the downside price pressures, even in Germany for many years, inflation tended to be the issue. And then suddenly a lot of the world, Europe, Japan, the United States was faced by potential deflation, and everyone started talking about Japanification, and a lot of European economies were especially interested, given and those European economies who were interested tended to be those who experienced aging of the population, and a lot of them that had current account surpluses like Germany. So I think there's probably a lot of ways in which Europe and some of the Asian economies can learn from each other, because now we've seen that even China is still relative young relative to Japan, but also aging. We all have to deal with this this problem of sustainability. And you know, while it's a beautiful thing that that we're able to live longer and healthier, a lot of times it's we're still looking at the optimal way to support a large population, a lot of the world's population doing that.
Yeah, one thing that Japan has, and that is the last question that we'll wrap up, that is in terms of immigration, and this is something that Germany has recently, over the last quarter century or so, really, well, I guess it goes back further, but the demographics in Germany, and there's been some articles on this recently, has really changed dramatically just over the last 20 years. And as they've also adjusted their citizenship requirements as a result. But Japan, I think, is still doesn't have all that much in terms of immigration, historically and still, right?
So I think whenever we think of the pace of change in Japan, typically, it tends to be more glacial than change
even
elsewhere. even slower than Europe in some cases. I mean, unless there's an immediate impetus to change. And I think that that because Japan has kind of been able to rely on the current account surplus and being able to stomach years and years of deflation without anything going seriously awry, then there hasn't really been a need as such to encourage large amounts of immigration. That said, there are changes as slow as they've been in coming. There's been some changes to visa requirements, especially in industries where there are skill shortages. And I can only imagine that as we go forward and skill shortages get more acute, that process is going to progress. If we take a look at a lot of the urban jobs, especially in casual workplaces, there are a lot more young people from Asia Pacific working in Japan. And, you know, I'm not sure how comprehensively they get considered into the labor statistics, because if you're a student, for example, you're a student, you're not officially part of the labor force. But there are changes afoot, perhaps not radical changes, not changes that are happening at a very fast pace, but perhaps more changes than immediately readily apparent.
Mm-hmm. Interesting, very interesting. Wouldn't you need to know Japanese though to do a consumer facing job in Japan?
You still do generally need to know Japanese, I think one of the famous high hurdles foreign-born nurses is that you have to pass the highest level of Japanese language test, I personally have done, I'm proud of it because it wasn't that easy. And so, if you're expecting somebody with no prior ties to Japan, who's already engaged in a career in the medical services to pass that exam. It can be done, but it's like it requires more doing than just getting another a job in another location where you don't have to learn a totally new language.
That sounds like a major obstacle. But there you go. If you put your Japanese, if you learn language Japanese as a young person, then maybe you are an advantage there. All right.
I did want to emphasize, though, that a lot of Japanese universities are trying to attract foreign talent. They are trying to increase their offerings in English, for instance, and they're trying to make their student body a little bit more international. So, I mean, again, I don't think that it's like it's the type of shift that you see in some economies that radically change their immigration policy, but things are changing, albeit slowly.
Mm-hmm. Cool. All right. Naomi Fink, thank you so much for joining the Contrarian Investor podcast today. In closing, maybe you can tell our listeners how they can find out more about you. You're not active on social media, I don't think. Your company website is europacifica.com. I know that. How else can they find out about you and maybe about your research?
Yeah, so europacifica.com is a good way. I am on LinkedIn. Although not on most other social media, so you can certainly find me on LinkedIn, and those interested can also fill in a contact form on our website.
I will link to those, and you do regular appearances still on CNBC and Bloomberg and such.
Well, I haven't done regular appearances for some time.
Okay.
So this is one of the, this is one of the first, I'm just, getting things restarted there, but, I am keen on re-engaging. And I thank all of the kind, media professionals who've been very patient with me, having to turn down a lot of these opportunities. So I'm anticipating that's going to change pretty shortly.
But you don't produce research or any kind of thought leadership or anything like that? And
it's coming.
Oh, it is. Very cool. All right. Watch that space, ladies and gentlemen. All right, Naomi Fink, thank you again for speaking to us today. Long conversation here. Very interesting stuff, a whole bunch of stuff. And with that, we'll shut up. Thank you for listening. Look forward to speaking to you all next week. See you then. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode. To subscribe to this podcast, simply open your favorite podcast software and search for Contrarian Investor. Follow us on social media by searching for Contrarian Investor on Twitter and Instagram. Send us your thoughts on feedback@contrarianpod.com. We look forward to speaking to you again next time.